This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The work of international diplomacy remains a mystery to most outside its realm. Fragile alliances and relationships can change the course of history and save thousands from death on the battlefield. But what magical combination of language, gesture, and personal chemistry fuels these vital agreements? Author Frederick Stanton takes a close look at eight such conversations in his book, Great Negotiations, Agreements That Changed the Modern World, and he is my guest this hour on The State of Things. Frederick, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
This book looks at eight negotiations from Benjamin Franklin's successful efforts in Paris to get the French to support the American Revolution to the Reykjavik summit in 1986. Why that time period?
Well, I wanted to cover negotiations that went back farther, but a lot of those had been lost to history. The exchanges had been lost to history. The filters that I used in choosing the negotiations were three. They had to have had a huge footprint. They had to have still affect our lives today. The people at the table had to have the ability to affect the outcome. It couldn't be a dictation of terms or a natural unfolding of events. And finally, there had to be enough material available to recreate the exchange of what happened so that I could put the reader at the table as the discussion took place. And I came up with these eight dramatic stories, as I say, the highest stakes poker games in history.
Starting with Benjamin Franklin in Paris, trying to convince the French to side with the Americans. And ultimately, it was his ability to scare them into the possibility of an American alliance with the English. Tell us about
that. Yeah, he had a very effective argument with the French. He said, look, if we Americans lose this war, we'll be reabsorbed into the British Empire, and that'll be very bad for France. He said, at the same time, if we win it without French support, that'll be bad for France as well. So he kind of stuck them in a fork argument. But what he really did was he used a ruse whereby he pretended to initiate discussions with the British to frighten the French into the fear that we were going to be reabsorbed into the British Empire. And that scared them enough to come to him with the draft treaty of alliance, which helped reverse the fortunes of war for the U.S. They provided a tremendous amount of material to the American revolutionaries.
There are seven others in this book, ending in 1986 in Reykjavik, including the Cuban Missile Crisis, the negotiations between Israel and Egypt in 1949, the Portsmouth Agreement in 1906. Why those particular eight agreements? I didn't name them all, but
yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, in each of them, the outcome was uncertain. The stakes were high, and it came down to the individuals at the table. One of the things that comes through, although it wasn't my intent, is you can track the rise and emergence of the U.S. as a great power through successes at the negotiating table. And one of the things that I point out in the introduction is that America has gained more at the negotiating table than it has by all of its wars combined. Now, partly it's because the wars that we fought have been defensive and we don't traditionally keep territory. But at the same time, things like the Louisiana Purchase, like Ben Franklin getting support for the American Revolution, like Theodore Roosevelt negotiating the end of the Russo-Japanese War, and even through the Cold War, you can track the growth and emergence of America power by its success at the negotiating table.
A real turning point had to be that Russo-Japanese War and Roosevelt's intervention, his acting as negotiator. What was in it for the U.S.? Why did Roosevelt feel that this was even important for the U.S. back then?
Well, it's a great question. He partly felt for humanitarian reasons that the war needed to end. There was a risk that the war would drag in other great powers and become a world war. And he also didn't want Russia to be defeated because that would upset the balance in Europe. At the same time, after the peace was concluded, he said, and I thought this was fascinating, I know that by removing Russia as a rival to Japan in the Pacific, this will inevitably lead to a war between Japan and the U.S., and that war will be the worst war the world has ever seen. He said, but my job is to make peace, and I've got to let the future take care of itself.
It is an amazing quote, an amazing insight to think that he had correctly predicted World War II, knew that that was the consequence. And I think that's one of the interesting things in reading this book. You begin to understand that just ending the war doesn't stop the trouble.
Yeah, history continues, and even things like making peace have often unintended consequences that lead to other things, and the march of history continues.
Let's talk about that particular agreement, because it did end in terms that were not favorable to Japan. Why would he make that prediction?
Well, I think he looked at the map and he saw strategically that Japan was a rising power, that it would seek to continue to expand, and at some point it would come up against another great power. If that wasn't Russia, it would probably be the U.S. He was a fan of Japan's. He admired the way that Japan had conducted itself in the war, but he just looked at the map and he saw that it would lead to distant future trouble with the U.S. But he felt deeply that the war was wrong and needed to end.
He said in the book, you quote him saying at the agreement, this is great for Japan, great for Russia, and great for me.
Yes, he realized that it was a huge success for him personally. He became the first American to win a Nobel Prize when he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. And an interesting thing about President Teddy Roosevelt, he's the only person to win both the Nobel Peace Prize and the Congressional Medal of Honor. So he won the highest award for both war and peace. But it was a great success for him.
For him and for the United States, did it put the U.S. on the map as a kind of world player?
It did, absolutely. The U.S. was an emerging economic power. It was an emerging military power. And this was his opportunity to put America's mark on the map as a state that could contribute to global stability and could make peace and could be a positive influence in world affairs. It really marked the emergence of the U.S. on the world diplomatic scene.
One of the great things about the book is it really takes you behind the scenes and into the room when these negotiations are going on, and then into the back rooms when both parties are receiving information, mulling it over. The book I'm talking about is Great Negotiations, Agreement That Changed the Modern World. Frederick Stanton is the author and my guest this hour, including these details that I guess insights into the process that we hadn't considered. 1949, mm-hmm. Armistice Agreement between Egypt and Israel. Poole played a big part in bringing that about.
Yes, that's right. One of the things that Ralph Bunche, who was the UN mediator, used to bring the two sides together was social interaction. And this was one of my favorite negotiations on a human level. In the beginning, neither side would look at, shake hands with, or talk to one another. And when they passed each other in the hallway, they would face the wall. And so he had to bridge gaps on an interpersonal level. And one of the things he did was with billiards and allowed them to get to know the other side, realize that they were people too. And that wore away at the distrust that allowed them to make one of the first peace negotiations in the modern Middle East.
There was another interesting personal factor here. Ralph Bunche, of course, an African-American, now negotiating for the United States in 1949. And you say that in some ways, the fact that he was African-American did play some part in this negotiation.
Yes, it was very helpful to him in that it allowed him to look at both the Israelis and the Egyptians and say, look, all of us at this table can talk about discrimination, can talk about the troubles that we've been through. I can, you can, or we can get down to work and move forward and be productive. And I think he had the credibility because of his background to do that in a way that other people wouldn't. And it was very, very effective in making that peace come together.
When you think about the way these negotiations were handled, the part of it is chemistry, part of it is personal relationships, and a lot of it has to do with place, where these negotiations took place. Tell us about that.
Yes, that's right. The place where the negotiations happen is a silent partner in the negotiations, and President Wilson said that diplomats are like lovers, and they must have proper surroundings. In the 1949 Armistice Accord negotiations, they were in Rhodes because it was isolated, it was secluded. The fact that the hotel had no heat and the food was terrible actually helped encourage the negotiators to move forward because they didn't want to be stuck there. In Iceland, Reagan and Gorbachev decided to meet in Iceland because it was literally and figuratively halfway between Washington and Moscow. But it was also secluded and isolated without any distraction, and they could talk to each other. The table was so small that when Secretary of State Shultz passed a note to Reagan, he was worried the Russian team would be able to read it. But that allowed them to develop a chemistry because it was so small and intimate that they could move forward and make a dramatic breakthrough.
And in Reykjavik, we had there was simultaneous translation, which also helped in the negotiations.
Yes, that was a very, very helpful innovation at that negotiation. It allowed the negotiators to connect the body language with the words that were being said, and that allowed them to develop a chemistry much more quickly and more deeply than it happened in the past.
The technology also plays a part. This was an innovation that didn't require much technology, but you can see a difference in the way negotiations are handled just by the what technology is available and its influence on those negotiations.
Absolutely. I mean, when you have negotiations like the Louisiana Purchase or Benjamin Franklin in Paris, the negotiators were almost entirely isolated. They had to make their own decisions. And then you have things like the Cuban Missile Crisis, where the transmission was almost instantaneous, where at the end, in fact, it was announced on radio, the final piece of the puzzle.
How do you think that plays a part in how the negotiations are conducted?
I think it moves the center of gravity more to the capitals. It gives the negotiators less freedom of movement to a certain degree. Unless they're the leaders themselves, as we saw it at Reykjavik. It also means that the power of the press, of course, is very important because that's instantaneous as well.
In the Cuban Missile Crisis, the press played a pivotal role. John Scali, who is the ABC State Department correspondent, was actually a go-between through much of those negotiations.
Yes. President Kennedy thought that going through the State Department bureaucracy would be too slow and cumbersome. And so one of the first things that both sides did was open up these secondary channels, partly because they wanted to get the message across quickly, partly because they wanted it to come through several means so that it was clear what was going on. The confusion was a great enemy during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
When you talk about transmitting information, using different channels, a big part of this has to do with your perception of the goals of the other side, what they know, what they don't know. There's what you know that's wrong, right, and what you don't know. And it strikes me that if we go back to the Portsmouth negotiations again, the Russians and the Japanese, at one point the Russian negotiator thought it would be a good idea to leak the Japanese demands to American papers because he felt that they were so outrageous that the Americans would side with the Russians and this would help propel Roosevelt. Good idea, except the Russian press picked it up. And so tell us how that sort of blew up in his face.
That's right. It backfired on him. He thought that it would help him, but it ended up hardening the Russian position back home, which ended up limiting his options. So it had the opposite effect.
It's interesting because what it tells you about these negotiators is how much unknown there is, how much guessing there is, guessing not only at what the other side really wants, what they know about us, all of which are guesses. Then you add that up, come up with a negotiating position, which is based on your sense of how they'll react.
It is. And one of the fun things about the book and one of the exciting things about the research was being able to put side by side perspectives from both sides. You know, you have declassified stuff on the American side from the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Reagan-Gorbachev meeting and from the Soviet side. And so you can see what the Americans were thinking, what they presumed the Russians were thinking, what the Russians really were thinking, what the Russians thought the Americans were thinking at each step of the negotiation. And it makes for terrific storytelling because we know more than the people at the table did.
Although guessing about how the other side will react is an important part of negotiations, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, there's a moment when the Joint Chiefs of Staff, particularly Curtis LeMay, is urging President Kennedy to launch a preemptive nuclear strike against the Soviet Union. Kennedy rejects this idea, anticipating the Soviet response. LeMay says there will be no response. Kennedy says they can't do nothing. This is a great insight, I think one that comes through in your book, about putting yourself in the place of the other before you make your move.
Yeah, it's very important to understand what the limitations are of the other side because there's room for maneuver, but there are usually places where the other side can't give for various reasons. And if you understand what the limitations are, it makes for much more effective problem solving in terms of negotiation.
Well, limitations, but also, yeah, their anticipated response that if we do this, something is going to happen to us. We're not living in a static world. The other side is alive, and they'll do something back.
Yes, and President Kennedy had just read Barbara Tuchman's book, The Guns of August, and was keenly aware that one of the reasons of that World War I was caused by the confusion and uncertainty and misinterpreted signals, and was very conscious not to make that same mistake again. So he was very cautious and wanted to be very clear about what was going on and what the Russians understood that he was doing. But there was great confusion anyway.
And you said that he had the sophistication to understand what kind of a General LeMay was, in this case, the one advising nuclear strike.
Yes, he was under tremendous pressure from the generals and from other quarters to move ahead and invade Cuba and initiate a war. He said later, and LeMay, you know, after the Cuban Missile Crisis was resolved, about a week later, said to President Kennedy, you know, it's not too late. We can still go in. President Kennedy said of LeMay that he's the perfect general when you're in a war to prosecute the war, but he's the wrong general to go to for advice over whether to initiate a war.
So knowing which generals to listen to for advice is important in anticipating a war. What's the most frightening bit of history, the most frightening nugget that you picked up in researching this book?
Well, I think the Cuban Missile Crisis was probably the closest the world has come to destroying itself. And we really came within a hair's breadth. After the Cuban Missile Crisis was resolved about 20 years later, the people from both sides got together to meet and share their experiences. And the Americans didn't know until that point that the Soviets had delegated command authority for the tactical nuclear weapons to the commanders in the field in Cuba. And so it would have certainly led to a war much quicker than even we knew. But that was probably the most chilling confrontation or near confrontation in human history.
One of the questions, too, the book raises, at least for me, is who they're negotiating for. When these negotiators are sitting there, who do they think they're representing? Is it something called the United States government, the people of the United States? You know, were Russian serfs going to be served by these negotiations in Portsmouth?
Well, it depends, and it's a good question. I mean, for instance, the Russian negotiator at Portsmouth disobeyed a direct command from the Tsar to break off negotiations, and he presented terms he wasn't authorized to give because he felt that in the end of the day it was better for Russia to end the war. And the terms were accepted, the war was ended, and the Tsar realized that he had made a mistake and the negotiator was right. So you have a certain independence of thought and movement in the negotiations that keeps them interesting. And often it depends, you know, who are you negotiating for?
Do you think these days, with accelerated pace of communication, technology, and the ability to launch a strike of any kind, that we are just in greater danger, that the likelihood of negotiation is now less and the likelihood of action greater?
Well, I think the stakes are as high as they've ever been. I think a great counterexample would be Reagan and Gorbachev in Iceland, where both sides realized that they had come so close for so long to nuclear war that the burden was so great on both countries that it was important to chart a new path. And they did. And I think that's the sort of thing that we should look to in the future.
Fred, thank you so much. Great talking with you.
Thank you.
My guest is Frederick Stanton. His book, Great Negotiations, Agreements That Change the Modern World. He's going to be talking about the book on Thursday at 7 o'clock, Barnes & Noble at Briar Creek in Raleigh. Next up, a fictional account of Donald Rumsfeld's retirement years. Stay with us on The State of Things.